The next case on the calendar is 95-2194 in re judicial campaign complaint against Kathleen Carr. Mr. Damiani.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, good morning. The case before you this morning is a case of first impression. It calls upon this court to interpret a rule which it enacted and which went into effect for matters which allege a violation of the Code of Judicial Conduct, Canon 7, effective September 1st, 1995. We submit that the rule as written and the rule as applied violate the due process rights of the respondent in this case. The rule itself does not permit flexibility with regard to application. It requires an immediate hearing within 5 days of the determination of probable cause. This may be contrasted with the court's other rule regarding all other matters involving allegations of a violation of the Code of Judicial Conduct, and I refer to GovBar Rule 5, which does state that upon reasonable notice, a panel shall hold a formal hearing, and a request for continuances may be granted for good cause shown. Now, in this particular case, notwithstanding the assertions of counsel for the complaint, there is no evidence in the file to suggest that nor any proof that suggests that there was any notice given to Kathleen Carr, the respondent, of the filing of this complaint on October 10th. There is no green card in the file, and there is no evidence that she ever was notified of. The first time she learned of the complaint was when she arrived home at 10:30 p.m. on Wednesday the 18th and got not only a copy of the complaint, but was served with notice that the hearing would occur on Monday, October 23rd. She attempted to retain counsel the next day, could not. We agreed to take the case over the phone on Friday. We immediately asked for a continuance. We did not have an opportunity to consult with our client, and our continuance request was denied. We had all of Saturday and Sunday to prepare for this hearing that was to be held on Monday morning in Columbus. We had no access to court files. We had no access to the Cleveland Municipal Court files, nor the Board of Commissioners on Grievances and Disciplines files.
Mr. Dummy.
Yes.
Excuse me. Of course, you could probably assume that when someone makes a statement that's being challenged, that prior to making that statement, the individual had the necessary proof or the reasons to believe that. What should a person need to make an investigation to confirm their statement? Wouldn't Judge or Ms. Carr have already done that, knowing that what she said was true?
Well, she was accused of being the author of three letters which were in the possession of her opponent in June of 1995, two of those, and one in September.
Investigation. I'm just wondering what you would have done if it hadn't been continued.
Certainly, one of the things that we would most certainly want to do is talk to campaign workers, consult with our client, have an opportunity. Now, one of the allegations here is that Kathleen Carr wrongfully accused her opponent of having never had handled a case in the housing court in Cleveland, which is the only court in the state that has a housing court. And we would have wanted to have investigated that to determine whether that was true or not.
Well, that's my point. Shouldn't she have already known that was true before it was said?
Well, that goes to the essence of the substance of the proof that was offered at the hearing. And the rule itself does not... it is not a strict liability rule. There has to be knowledge demonstrated at a hearing, and the evidence has to be clear and convincing that the person accused of a violation of the Code of Judicial Conduct knew that had knowledge that the statement made was not correct. And furthermore, there has to be evidence evidence demonstrated at the hearing, and in this case, there was not.
Well, no. So that I could understand what you're asserting there, you said the person charged would have to get to show that they had knowledge that it was false.
The person charged would not have to show that. The person making
right,
the allegation would have
right.
to show that.
That the person charged did have knowledge that it was false. You're not arguing that your client or any other person in this kind of situation can just make a bold-faced assertion without any foundation for that and skate off of a charge saying, well, I didn't know it was false. I didn't know it was true either. I didn't know anything. I just said it.
I'm not suggesting that, Your Honor.
Okay.
What I am suggesting, first, in this case, what occurred at the hearing on this matter was the three letters were introduced into evidence over our objection. They were not admissible because they were not authenticated. There was no testimony to show that any of the signatures on any of the letters, and a couple of them were Xerox copies, were authored by Kathleen Carr, and there was no expert testimony, and there were no witnesses or lay testimony of anyone who could testify.
But she did. She was the best person. She didn't come to the hearing, and didn't really, as I understand, didn't give a reason for not coming to the hearing. Is that correct, or is that not correct?
It is correct. She did not attend the hearing. She was not required to attend the hearing under the rule.
Well, but she can't come now and say, well, you know, that was my signature on that. You know, the board commission found that was my signature because it purported to be. But I passed up my chance to come and say that's not my signature.
Well, the court is going to create a rule which places the burden upon anyone accused to come and deny the accusation instead of what the rule does say, and that is that by clear and convincing evidence, the burden is upon the person making the charge. One should not be required to appear to give testimony against oneself where no other testimony is forthcoming. Now, I might add that the complainant in this case could have subpoenaed Kathleen Carr to be at the hearing, chose not to, and relied solely on, I guess, a belief that she would appear and be called as a witness.
But this is not a criminal action. This is a civil action. This is a civil action if you don't show, you risk the burden that you're going to fail on your burden of proof.
We are in the event that there's a burden of proof on the respondent in this case. There was no burden of proof on the respondent in this case. She did have counsel present. The burden was on the complainant to demonstrate by clear and convincing evidence that a violation occurred. I don't know how the court can ignore the fact that the rules of evidence are required to be followed in these hearings, and that the rules of evidence would call for authentication of any letter or any signature that is produced and wished to be admitted into evidence. And therefore, these letters should not have been admitted. And on that basis, what happened here, the panel made presumptions and inferences. Now, I believe Mr. Phillips, in the transcript, made the inference that because she did not appear to deny an accusation, she would be punished for that. And glossed right over the fact that there was an obligation on the part of the complainant to prosecute the case.
I thought, is it correct that the panel apparently had other copies of other signatures, copies of her signatures that they compared and believed that the signature on this campaign literature was similar or close enough that they concluded it was her signature?
Well, there's no doubt they concluded that, but I don't know how they could reach that conclusion if there was no testimony. There was no one who could. And here's what we're talking about, and I think everyone in this room is aware of the fact that in campaigns, judicial and otherwise, many people do things that are not known by the candidate, either on the side for the candidate or on the side against the candidate. And to just naturally assume that because a document appears in the mail and has someone's name on it, that is credible evidence And it should be, it rises to the level of clear and convincing evidence where there has been no authentication of that document.
Well, you're right, but, Mr. Dummy, I think to be very practical about it, when a piece of campaign literature goes out and has something on it that says, we need your help now, and has the signature of the candidate, I think the candidate should at least assume that somebody's going to infer that that's her signature, and she ought to be down here at a hearing to say, that's not my signature, this is an unauthorized piece of campaign literature. It does happen, you're right, but I can't see why the panel could, in the absence of any retort from her, why the panel could not conclude this piece of campaign literature was signed by her.
Well, if Mr. Chief Justice, if the rule required her to be here, or if she was subpoenaed, or if the rule would suggest that she had a burden to show cause why she should not be deemed to have violated the code of judicial conduct, then I would agree with you. But your rules say completely the opposite. They do not place a burden upon the respondent to appear in a case of this nature. And I would say that it could even be considered malpractice on the part of a lawyer to suggest that a person whose license is at issue, and we're told by the panel in this case, the Honorable Judge White, that one of the sanctions that could have been imposed here was disbarment or suspension of the license. And think about that. From Friday afternoon to Monday morning, you can lose your license. And you're supposed to appear without any information as to what's going to transpire. And your own rules will certainly bear this out, that there are procedures in place that would protect sitting judges or judges in other situations, procedural safeguards, an opportunity to answer, an opportunity to have discovery, an opportunity to prepare a defense. And when what is at issue here, and I think what the problem with this rule is, as I see it anyway, is that if when the court enacted this rule, it definitely filled a void that was needed because we know that the Election Commission would always bounce these back to the Board of Commissioners on grievances and say, well, they have no jurisdiction. But I think where the court went too far is that instead of just limiting it to a cease and desist order or a potential fine, where the potential for a sanction, where you could lose your license on an expedited hearing, I think it would be malpractice to submit a client to that type of hearing without an opportunity to fully prepare for a hearing. And that's what I believe we have in this case.
It is your reading of the rule that someone could lose their license by this commission rather than the commission finding there was some infraction of the rule and then referring to disciplinary counsel.
Well, it's my reading of the rule. Not only that, it's on page 6 of the transcript. Judge White advises us that one of the possible sanctions could be a suspension of the license. He doesn't say disbarment, but he does say suspension of the license. And I think the rule was ambiguous because it does refer to disciplinary sanctions. And then it goes to Rule 6A of, or excuse me, Section 6A of Rule 5 for the Rules of Government of Bar. And it refers to the sanctions listed in Section 6, one of which is disbarment. So I believe that this rule could be read and could be interpreted, and this panel believed it could, by the statement of its chairman on page 6, that there could be a sanction imposed or recommended to this court where someone could be suspended on an expedited hearing. And I believe that because that's at risk here, that there should be no leaps of faith to suggest that a document can be held up to the light compared to another document, neither of which have been authenticated by anyone, and say that looks like her signature, and because she's not here to deny it, we're going to infer it's her.
From what you said, I get the impression that you advise her not to appear at this hearing because of what you've already said, which was an improper type of hearing.
Your Honor, without getting into what I advise my client to do, I would say that it's clear from the rule that she was not required to be here, and she was not subpoenaed to be here, and she did participate in the hearing through counsel, and it was the burden of the complainant to bring this case and prosecute it. And it's not our fault that they came here with no ability to authenticate the documents they were relying upon.
Without all the contingencies and experience and so forth, what you're saying in essence is that the proof was sorely lacking to show that she authored this letter for that she had anything to do with this letter.
There was no proof.
That's what you're saying.
Absolutely. None. No credible proof.
This is not even a court action. I would consider it to be a civil action. It is a procedure under a rule of the Supreme Court based on a license to practice law, which is a privilege. Now, and what we have here is a document, in this sort of action, we have a document that is authenticated to the extent that this was received in the mail. And someone, the complainant, said, I received this document. We're going to say they have to then say, prove that it was. I think what goes with that is an inference, whose signature is on it, and we can assume that and require that anybody in the campaign has to know what's going on with their campaign workers or prove that they don't. I think there's an inference there in this sort of proceeding. If that is your signature, and until you deny it, where does it say you got to prove that it's their signature?
Well, Your Honor, the rules that you've enacted say the exact opposite, and therefore, if the rules said what you just said, then I would agree with you. But the rule says that the burden of proof is clear and convincing evidence. And the rules say that the rules
but
of evidence...
So you can't infer that a letter with someone's signature is under their direction.
If the rules of evidence apply, which they do, in the matters before the Board of Commissioners on Grievances and Discipline, and I refer you specifically to Rule 5, I don't have it in front of me, but the rules of evidence do apply unless they are otherwise by some other rule obviated. There are no other rules that obviate those, and therefore I know of no way that you can get into the record a letter without some type of authentication. It is not a self-authenticating document, and under your theory, people could send mass mailings out, put every judge's name on the court on those letters, and someone could come down and file a request for an expedited hearing, and everyone would have to come in and say, well, I don't know about that, or it's not my signature. And your rules do not provide for that. Your rules provide for whoever files that complaint and asks for an expedited hearing, does so with the burden on them not to infer anything, but to actually prove by clear and convincing evidence. And I suggest that there's no way this document is self-authenticating, and there was no testimony. In fact, the complainant in this case said, I don't know her signature.
You've answered.
Thank you.
You've used your time also. Thank you. Ms. Bruner?
My name is Jennifer Bruner, and I represent the complainant in this matter, Raina Del Pianca. I think it's best to proceed to respond to several of the issues raised by Mr. Damiani. I think what I want to impress most upon this court is that the standard of review that was required of the panel and of the commission was clear and convincing evidence. We also need to look at the fact that what they needed to find was that there was clear and convincing evidence that Ms. Carr had knowledge of those statements being made and also of the solicitation being made. We're essentially dealing with a false statement and a personal solicitation of campaign funds by a candidate. So those are the two, it's Canon 70-2S and Canon 70-2. What we had were documents on which appeared a signature that said Kathleen Carr.
That's when it goes to that part of both those charges. The proof by clear and convincing evidence that Kathleen Carr authorized this mailing and she signed the mailing in her own signature, thus showing that she authorized it and she was responsible for this item. Isn't that something you would have to prove by clear and convincing evidence? And that you did, but you have to do that. Tell me how you did that.
The way that we did that was in several ways. First of all, looking at this court's standard of what is clear and convincing evidence, indicates that in re election of November 6, 1990 for office of the Attorney General of Ohio, the court said several things about what is clear and convincing evidence.
No, I don't care about clear and convincing evidence. I want you to tell me the evidence that you produced at this hearing that you tried to show was clear and convincing evidence.
I understand. I think I may have been taking too long.
Just the evidence, the testimony, the witnesses, the expert testimony, all that stuff, I'd like to have you tell me what it was.
The evidence was, first of all, the evidence, the testimony of my client, Raymond Pianca. The testimony of my client, Raymond Pianca. We stipulated to the testimony of Donna Gagnon, who had actually been the person who had received the letter to the central or the executive committee members of the Democratic Party in Cuyahoga County, who would be able to say, yes, this is a letter that I received, and I believed it to be that, I believe that it was from Kathleen Carr, that it contained a signature that said Kathleen Carr. We did not have an expert there to compare her signature, for instance, to the voter registration records in Cuyahoga County, mainly because we believed that she would be there and we'd be able to question her. As far as being able to subpoena her, I don't believe that there would have even been time to effectuate the logistics of that. But
is counsel correct in saying that Ms. Carr didn't have to be there and she didn't have any burden of proof whatsoever?
No, he is correct in saying that the rule did not specifically require that she be there.
So if they don't require that she be there, it's not necessary and she can be absent.
That's correct. We also were faced with the same time constraints that the respondent was because, as the record shows, all notices in this case simultaneously went to both parties.
Now, my second question was, does she have any burden of proof?
Does she have any burden of proof? She does to some extent because this is not a criminal matter. This is more than preponderance of the evidence, but it is less than beyond a reasonable doubt.
She must help you in showing clear and convincing evidence, is that what you're saying?
Clear and convincing evidence also involves a firm belief in the mind of the trier of the fact that the facts establish what you're supposed to.
Yes, let's stay on the one point I'd like you to answer, is that does she have the burden of proof, and if she does, what did she have to do to further that burden?
I think I'll put it this way. It was not unreasonable for the panel, based on the evidence which I haven't gone through completely for you yet, to conclude that that was her signature. And for her to now come and claim, because she wasn't there, that how do you know that that was my signature? And she didn't actually, because if it was not her signature, she should have been there to say, this was a mistake. I'm a judicial candidate.
Well, then she does have the burden of proof to come forward and rebut
that is
the
correct.
Presumption that she signed the letter.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
All right, so really, your burden is, I don't know what it is, but she does have some obligation to come forward and rebut that presumption. So there's a, going into the hearing, there is a presumption, a legal presumption, that she signed that article, and then it passes to her to come in and say, that isn't mine. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not saying that exactly. There was an exhibit 8 that was offered as additional evidence, which was a piece of campaign literature that's in the record that contained her picture and a signature. We had the testimony of the candidate, Raymond Pianca, that ordinarily a candidate is going to put their own signature on a piece of literature like this that's
distributed. One last question, and I'll leave the issue. Did you have anyone or anything that says, yes, I've seen her signature before, that's her signature?
A very straight answer to that question is no. We didn't have time to find anyone who could do that.
Okay, so it was a time constraint that you felt you didn't need to sort of slide over what you had to prove. It's because you had to do it in a hurry.
I wouldn't want to characterize it as sliding over what we had to prove. We had to do the best that we could.
Well, you certainly didn't prove anything as far as I can see, but she signed it. Period.
The commission was, the panel was permitted to obtain a firm belief in their mind as the trier of fact that this was her signature. They had three different documents, actually four different documents entered into evidence that contained the signature of Kathleen Carr. They were able to compare, and they believed upon their comparison that those signatures all resembled each other closely enough. I think that there is very little likelihood that any trier of fact would conclude that on four different pieces of campaign literature, the candidate had not signed any of them. I think that's very unlikely for all the people who've been candidates who are involved in these decisions. I think they know that when their signature is required, they're the ones who sign it, unless it's unless they have some kind of exception in their mind. And generally, if it's a piece of literature that's going to be printed and published, that's likely the candidate's signature.
Aren't you relying on the principle that we apply, certainly in civil cases, that if someone makes an allegation to a fact or presents a document that purports to say something, if no one contests that, if no one says that's wrong, that there is at least a strong presumption that is correct, that it speaks, it is what it says it is. Isn't that what the panel here was really forced to do, because there was no evidence contra the piece of campaign literature that purportedly had her signature?
I do believe that's what occurred. If we look at Division F of Canon 7 dealing with accountability, the judicial candidate shall be responsible for the content of any statement communicated if the candidate knew of the statement. When we look at a signature that appears on a statement, we've got to infer that the candidate knew of it. It's inescapable that the candidate's signature appears on the statement. That occurs with the letter that included false statements that my client had never handled any cases in housing court. It also occurs with the solicitation where there's the handwritten note, "We need your help now, Kathleen." And if you look at the contents of that letter, it's clearly a solicitation for funds and no more than that.
On the housing court issue, the misrepresentation, so-called misrepresentation of fact that the majority of the commission found, what's the significance of the fact that the candidate did not include experience at the housing court in the bio that we now require, the list of activities and special experience that we now require candidates to make available to voters?
The significance of that, the specific statement he made was, "I have filed evictions before various municipal courts and have handled extensive real estate matters." I do not know why there was not a specific mention made of the Cleveland Housing Court, but I will say that the respondent in this case, let's put it this way, on cross-examination it came out that there is no index of attorneys or cases that, so in order to learn whether or not my client had handled cases in the municipal housing court, she would have had to have gone through thousands and thousands of cases. Now, she had been a referee in that court in the past, so she was clear that it would be easy to understand that she would be aware of that, as well as my client's testimony. If that's the case, my client also testified that she never asked him whether he handled any of those cases. So in getting to this question of knowledge and the case law on this, whether you look at State Actual Citizens for Responsible Taxation or you go to the further step that the commission did in State v. Edwards, it's clear that it was very probable that her failure to investigate that would result in a false statement. I hope I didn't go beyond answering the question.
No, I understand your answer.
Issues of whether or not there was a denial of due process. I believe the fact that counsel, that respondent had counsel there at the hearing to represent her is adequate enough due process. In our brief, we have cited situations, specifically the cases of State v. Souders and State v. Adkins, where this court has found that 11 days and even 5 days notice that you're going to need a witness is adequate time and that there is no abuse of discretion in denying a motion for continuance.
So I'm sorry to understand you, counsel. You're claiming you can manage to find a lawyer and get them to the hearing. That's sufficient evidence that all the due process
Constitution might require is satisfied.
Your Honor, in the case of State v. Adkins, this was a criminal case, and 5 days before, 5 days prior to the motion for continuance, the defense counsel knew that there was a possibility of the need for a rebuttal witness. Didn't do anything, asked for the continuance, the court denied it, and the appellate court found that there was no abuse of discretion, that the 5 days was adequate time to know, to get that rebuttal witness. In this case, we have testimony to Kathleen Carr, we have the statement of the counsel that she had a little less than 5 days notice. She found out at 10:30 at night on the 18th about this hearing. She would have had all day Thursday, all day Friday, to go to the records of the Board of Commissioners on Grievance and Discipline, or the records of the Housing Court if she needed records there. That wasn't done. In fact, she didn't even obtain counsel until Friday before the hearing. My client was in the same position. The notices were, they were both in Cleveland. The notices were sent simultaneously. He was diligent.
Well, except your client did know when the complaint was going to be filed.
Pardon me?
Your client did know when the complaint was going to be filed.
He filed a complaint, but the process after that is for the Secretary of the Board of Commissioners and Grievances to actually review it and file his own complaint. And the notice he received of that was the same as what she received. I can tell you that I was not contacted until he received notice that there was going to be a hearing. I knew nothing about the case until that time.
Counsel, tell me, is there a statute of limitations that defines complaints to be filed?
I'm sorry.
Is there a time limit within you, wherein you have to file a complaint?
I know of none in the rules.
So you can file a year later, 2 years later, whatever time it is. Is that correct?
I really don't know the answer to that question. I would point out that, in closing, that persons who are called to the law are called to a higher standard than the mere morals of the marketplace. I think to allow the respondent to prevail in this matter by simply not appearing, so that there was difficulty in proving that this actually was her signature, actually frustrates the whole process. Canon 7 is effective in that finally, it allows and actually forces candidates to think very carefully and to proceed very carefully before making statements in the campaign. We all know that the most furious and fast-paced part of the campaign occurs right before the election. This complaint was filed in the last month before the election. This process allows for there to be some type of adjudication, at least by the panel, if not by the commission, which did occur in this instance, so that the candidate who actually prevails in the case, in this case it was my candidate, has the benefit of disseminating the information that these false statements that were made about him were in fact false. And it also puts the respondent in a position, such as this respondent, to stop making those statements, so that what we're dealing with is more integrity in the process. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Byrne. Mr. Damiani, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds to rebuttal, if you want.
Thank you for that courtesy, Mr. Chief Justice. I would just point out that once again that the important thing to note here is that there was no inference that could be made by documents that were not authenticated. There was really no evidence before the commission to consider.
How does this, the idea that this is an adversary proceeding in your view, probably close to a criminal proceeding, how can that be reconciled with the requirement that the lawyers cooperate with the disciplinary process?
I think in this case, we did cooperate with the process. We appeared, and we had the right to appear. And she was not required to appear, and she was not subpoenaed by the outside. And your rules talk about the failure to testify, the sanction for failing to testify in your own rules is contempt. It is not to assume that because you fail to appear, we're not required, that everything that is said. These documents are not the type of document. These could have been made by anyone and mailed to anyone, and we're presuming that that signature is not a forged signature or not a Xerox signature on top of it. These are copies, some of these. And we know that that can happen as easily as having a Xerox machine. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Damiani. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.